as I'm sitting over at John instead of working. All right, ready? All right. The House Committee on Revenue will come to order. Thank you all for being here this afternoon, February 10th, 2015. We're going to open an information meeting on debt management. I assume that you're introducing it.
Mr. Chair, actually, I am just here for the bills after that,
but okay.
This one is it is one of my subject portfolios, and this is the Debt Policy Advisory Commission report, and we asked the State Treasurer's Debt Office and the bonding section to come and present this to you as they do every session. Every session.
Thank you. And I'm tempted for the new members. Do we have new members? Yeah, we do have new members. To simply say welcome. It's very great, wonderful to have you here. Laura Lockwood McCall and I got to know each other probably more than either of us would have preferred in this method by the fact that we talked at least once a week during the debt crisis in 2008 about Oregon's debt and how it was being managed. And I have to say I have enormous respect for her and for the Treasurer's Office and the way they manage Oregon state debt. And needless to say, you didn't hear anything about what happened in 2008 and 2009 in Oregon because they just made it work. Is that enough introduction? I suspect it is. Laura, go ahead. Thank you very much.
Hi. For the record, my name is Laura Lockwood McCall. I'm the Director of the Debt Management Division of the Oregon State Treasury. One of the various tasks that we do in debt management is we staff the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission, and we produce an annual report, basically, with input from the commission members. It is composed of the chair, which is the state treasurer. There are two legislative representatives, one from the House and one from the Senate. Currently, your noble chair has been a longstanding member. Senator Devlin is the Senate representative. We have the director of DAS, and then we have a public member. For the last several years, it's been Tim Dewey, an economist with the University of Oregon. So that is the group of people who reviewed this report that I'm going to just give you some highlights from today. There's a lot of material, so I would just encourage you to ask me questions along the way. I may have a future slide, but I'll try and answer your questions without boring you to tears to give you sort of a broad overview of how the process and the research and the forecasting works. So the next slide just shows you the main statutory framework of what we're supposed to do in the annual report. We're looking at the overall long-term trends in state debt. We're making recommendations of prudent debt capacity, both for lottery bonds and general fund supported debt. And if there are any issues of concern in the debt management world at the state level, we try and highlight those for the legislature and the governor for potential future policy changes. So very quickly, some debt capacity concepts I mentioned. There's four different kinds of debt. We have general obligation bonds. In our state constitution, there's a debt prohibition on incurring any debt greater than $50,000 unless there's a carve-out in the constitution. So you'll be hearing about Article 11, A, F, G, all these letters, and what that represents are voter approvals of those carve-outs for different bond programs. We'll be talking a little bit more about those in the future. There's both some general obligation bonds that we sell are general fund-backed, which you probably care a lot about because those are precious dollars. But there's a number of general obligation bond programs that are not general fund supported that support loan programs, including programs for veterans loans for mortgages, as well as energy loans and other loans for the university system for dormitories and other types of things where there's a revenue stream that pays the debt. We have direct revenue bonds where, the revenue stream that's been pledged pays the debt service, and there is no general fund obligation or full faith and credit obligation of the state. Examples would be things like the highway trust fund that we have that pays highway bonds. We also do it with lottery bonds that are revenue bonds, and we'll talk more about those as I go forward. We have had a lot of appropriation credits, which, again, we didn't get the carve out necessarily from the voters to sell bonds, but we pledge to make annual appropriations to pay the debt. Historically, those were certificates of participation, and we did some other appropriation bonds I'll describe in the future. And then lastly, we have pure conduit bonds. So the state puts its name on a bond issue that promotes an activity that's supported, that's tax exempt under federal tax law. So for example, affordable housing, we are just a conduit. They're revenue bonds. The revenue streams are paid by whoever's doing the affordable housing. So it's not the state's credit, but we are a vehicle to facilitate their financings. So this is the big picture look at the state's credit in terms of outstanding debt over the last decade. And as you can see that our debt levels on all the different categories, and I hope you have this more, but the purple is pension obligation bonds, and we'll talk about that. Those are GO bonds that were approved by voters, but it was for the funding of unfunded liabilities and PERS. The red, which is where the real growth has been in direct revenue bonds, and primarily that's been in the area of ODOT's bonds over the last decade. The green are these appropriation credits, and you can see that's been shrinking and will continue to shrink away. We'll talk about why that is in other slides. And then the blue at the bottom is all the other GO bonds we have besides the pension bonds. It peaked in about 2000, fiscal year 10, and at that point we have some debt capacity rules of the road, and revenues were off a bit, and so we backed off and sold fewer bonds. Remember we actually went a couple years without issuing any general fund backed bonds. And some of that is due to ODOT programs that we sold bonds for that we didn't need to sell new bonds. So we've been at roughly the same levels, a little over $10 billion. This excludes the conduit bonds. These are all bonds that the state, some sort of form of loan or revenue or general fund monies of the state. So this next page is just the GO bonds, and we've talked about some of the categories, and that has been growing. It's we ended the fiscal year 14 at a little bit over $5 billion. Obviously, the largest chunk of that was for pension obligation bonds. That was a decision made by the legislature in 2003, and we sold a little over $2 billion in bonds to convert an unfunded liability in PERS into a now funded program at PERS, and we carry the debt on our books. We've also decided no longer to sell COPs. A few years back, the legislature authorized us to do a constitutional amendment to get out of COP business and to sell GO bonds, and it was primarily for things like prisons, state mental hospitals, and things that were just public facilities that didn't have a specific carve-out in the Constitution. But we saw an opportunity if in the future that we could refund at a higher credit rating and a lower cost of funds if we went away from using COPs, which had a lower credit rating, to the GOs. And we have, we're about to do another refunding. But since 2011, we've refunded over $400 million of our COPs into Q bonds, and we've saved in the neighborhood of $57 million in interest costs already. And we'll continue to do that as we go forward.
And that's a direct reduction of the hit against the general fund.
This is correct.
So that means that the co-chairs of Ways and Means have $50 million more to spend. Over a 20-year period on something else.
Yes. Right. And we refund bonds in all the other categories as well. But this just one little change from using this appropriation method to GO was a great move on behalf of the legislature.
I have a question.
Oh, yes, Representative Whitsitt.
What would the interest have been? What would the interest have been on the Q bonds, the total interest owed that you say you're saving $57 million? What is that on a total interest?
Okay, so I'm going to answer it slightly differently,
okay.
Hopefully through the chair. So we had roughly a few years ago about $1 billion of COP debt in general.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we refund it, we take and that's the principal amount.
Mm-hmm.
So that principal amount had different interest rates. I don't know whether it was 3, 4, 5, 6%. And I can't tell you in every specific case. But in the then current market, when we had a chance to refund, we still have to pay back the principal, but we were able to replace it with GO bonds. And so the new bonds were sold at a bit lower interest rates. And I don't have the number about the average lower, but what you do is you calculate what is the interest on the old bonds, what's the interest on the new bonds, and you subtract one from the other. And so the interest portion is reduced by $57 million. It's like when you refinance your mortgage, You still have to pay the principal and the mortgage, but you come in at a lower rate.
I understand that. I was just wondering, what do we owe principal and interest out into the length of those loans?
Through the chair, I can get that for you. I also think in the SDPAC report itself, we have a lot of detail on annual debt service, and so we'll have to look and see if we've got that specific, the refundings, but I can have someone pull those numbers together.
Great, thank you.
If somebody will keep track of my questions.
And that's online, isn't it, the report?
I think so, and I also believe it's delivered to each individual hard copy.
Yeah, I got one a couple days ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's a lot of backup material in the report and in the appendices.
But if it is online, we could also post it as part of today's documents. And I'll let staff figure that out.
But I'll have to pull out the specific ones that are tied to the refundings.
Right.
Because it's probably lumped in with everything else.
Right.
Okay. So in terms of the revenue bonds, as I've mentioned, if you look at this, you'll see the growth in the revenue bond that we have. It peaked in 2010, as I mentioned. The big chunk of it is the $2.8 billion in the highway user tax bond program that funded OTIA 1, OTIA 2, OTIA 3, and is now starting to fund the Jobs and Transportation Act bonds. There's been a growth in lottery revenue bonds, particularly once we went to video line games. There was a big bump up in revenues in the early part of this past 10-year period, and the legislature authorized additional bonding at higher levels that corresponded with that revenue increase. The third program I should mention that I haven't is the blue, and that's both single-family and multifamily mortgage revenue bonds that are, again, completely loan-based in terms of the repayment streams issued through Oregon Housing Community Services Department. These appropriation credits that we were just describing, you can see that we peaked at actually even higher than a billion. We were at $1.7 billion in 2010, and we've been mightily, as fast as we can, refunding and reducing the amount of appropriation bonds. We have an upcoming refunding, in fact, in early March, that will knock off another $200 million, give or take, of our appropriation debt, with a present value savings projected of about $15 million. So when we look at debt capacity and provide these capacity forecasts to legislature, we're focusing on general fund supported debt. And we'll talk about what are the categories in there. The commission has long had a policy that's been adopted by both the legislature and the governor of making sure that annual debt service on this general fund supported debt does not exceed 5% of the state's general fund revenues. It's just been a long-term rule of thumb. We've looked at other states. Some states have a 6%, some states have a 4%, but general rule of thumb we've been using for many years now is 5%. We look at lottery-backed debt, and in that case, we were the first state to start a lottery-backed bond program at the time that we created it. It hadn't been done in the United States. We were very conservative. We said that it should have 4 times coverage or no more than 25% of lottery revenues as a percentage of overall debt service to all lottery revenues. And we also have a moral obligation of the state to replenish, if we ever have to touch our debt service reserve funds, to replenish those. There's other states, two other states that have done lottery bond programs. They have lower coverage than we do. But on a practical matter, the more that we tie up lottery dollars in debt service, the less dollars we have to fund operating costs for schools, for economic development, parks, to fund our educational stability fund. So we've left that 4 times coverage. And as you'll see, we have very high credit ratings for our lottery bond program, in some cases higher than the state's credit rating because of the cushion that is achieved by having this high coverage. I'll talk about net tax-supported debt, which is a lot more debt than just general fund, and that's a way that the rating agencies compare us to other states. And then I'll touch briefly on a few non-tax-supported debt issues. So the chart above shows you all the different kinds of both GO bonds and other types of bonds that are considered general fund-supported. And in parentheses, you have some percentages, because not all of the bonds that are GO bonds are 100% general fund-supported. So this is the laundry list of the programs that are in and out. And as of June 30th, we had $2.7 billion that was considered general fund supported debt out of the $5 billion plus of GO bonds. We have a model that forecasts out based on what the legislature has authorized in the bond bill, which I believe for last session was Senate Bill 5506. We assume that all the debt that was authorized by the legislature will be sold between now and the end of the biennium. We take the existing debt as of June 30th, so we know what that annual debt service number is. And then basically, you can see what was in our model. This is all the things that were approved by the legislature. We use the most recent revenue forecast we have, which was the December forecast OEA produces. It goes beyond the two-year biennium. Actually, the OEA does a 10-year forecast, and we use that long-term revenue forecast in the model. And from that, we're able to say how much additional new debt service we can afford, which translates into debt at a given interest rate. And every time we meet, we talk about what long-term interest rates should be, and none of us really know with exact precision what that number should be. But I can show you that that chart shows you the index that we use, which is a long-term 20-bond index of what long-term rates will be in 20 years. And you can see it's been pretty sporadic, particularly it was particularly high in the 08-09 period. Then it dropped dramatically. Then it went back up and down. And so it's been a little difficult to write on, pick what that long-term rate will be. But obviously, the rate you choose affects your capacity. So we try and be conservative. So the long-term average over the last decade has been in the neighborhood of 4.5%. But right now, rates are 3.5%. So we're constantly trying to say, well, should we use current rates? Should we use more conservative? So I've never exactly hit it right. I always pick a high rate when things are dropping and a low rate when things are going up. But you can sort of see in the last several years, we've bounced around between about 4.5% and 5.5% as a number in the model. Based on this math, we project out maximum amounts that can be done. And when we say maximum, that doesn't mean we should just do it because it's the maximum at the 5%. But just to give people a flavor of, based on those revenue forecasts, how much more room we have. A few years ago, I mentioned we were at our 5% limits. And so as a result, the legislature and the governor backed off at the height of the recession, and we didn't sell a lot of bonds. Well, the economy picked up, revenues picked up, but we didn't sell a lot of bonds. So you can see we're projecting we'll end the year, even after we sell the bonds that have been authorized, and we'll be at 3.5%. So that's a good news, because a couple of years ago, I was having to do this presentation and recommend to people who wanted to do a lot of projects that, you know, this was not a good time to do it. You can see we get a big bump in the following year, and then you can see where it falls down. But the bottom line is we project out through 2023 that there's roughly $3.9 billion in general fund debt capacity. Generally, the commission recommends that we don't use it up all at once right away because of interest rate movements as well as general fund movements. So we average out that capacity. So basically, we divide by, in this case, four bienniums to come up with a per biennium average, which would be 974 per biennium. There's no magic to that, you know, methodology. If there's more projects that need to be funded and it's important, then I'd really encourage the legislature to do more. If not, to do less. But this has sort of been the methodology we've used, and it's kept us out of trouble in terms of our debt service tying up too many dollars in of the general fund as the economy, if the economy is heading down. It keeps us from tying up too many dollars. We also give you interest rate sensitivities, if I'm wrong, in terms of the direction of where interest rates are going, and you can see how it affects the 8-year forecast as well as the per biennium forecast. Particularly probably focusing is on if there's 10% declines in general fund revenue, because that has a much stronger impact on the numbers than really interest rates do. Lottery back. We had $1.1 billion of lottery back debt as of the end of the fiscal year, and we've used lottery bonding for every type of economic development, education, parks, everything you can think of, because it's our most flexible dollars in terms of the kinds of projects we can fund. We sell lottery bonds both on a tax-exempt and taxable basis based on the use of the funds, because there are restrictions under the federal tax code in terms of getting the tax exemption if it's particularly going to benefit a private party. A lot of our Connect Oregon projects that are for private sector have to be sold on a taxable basis. But it's been used for all different kinds of programs. The model, again, just assumed that all the lottery bonds that have been authorized by the legislature were sold. with a few exceptions. We were able to free up some debt service reserves in a most recent financing we did, so we netted that part out because we used cash, in essence, to fund some of the projects that would have otherwise been bonded. But otherwise, we used exactly what the legislature authorized. We used the December forecast, and we used the same interest rate to get to our capacity numbers. Unfortunately, this is not the best chart in the world, but this is a chart that the commission spent a lot of time on. Over the last few years, the long-term forecast that OEA has done in terms of where lottery revenues will be in the long term has dropped. You can see the green shows you what the long-term forecast was for lottery revenues in 2012. And it's considerably higher than what it is in the other forecasts. They began a video replacement program a couple of years ago, and so we needed to incorporate that into the model. And that's what that's circled, and that's what the red, and there's sort of a blue underneath it, just is reflecting there was going to be this drop-off that wasn't anticipated in terms of revenues. And our coverages have gotten much tighter, and it's affected, obviously, our debt service coverage, but also operating dollars that are available to other parts of state government while this program was being done. But the most recent forecast this December from OEA suggests that even after that program is done, that lottery revenues were not going to grow at the kind of pace that it historically done. And that has huge implications for long-term lottery bond capacity, but also for long-term funding of programs on an operating basis that relied on lottery dollars. There's a report that was completed by OEA in October talking about long-term trends and changes in the gaming industry, and we're seeing those trends reflected in this lower revenue number.
Representative Whitsitt.
So the circled area back there, you're saying that that was a one-time conversion of the lottery system to something else. That's a pretty steep incline on the bottom two lines between 16 and 17. Are you just extrapolating between 15 then?
Those are literally the numbers that OEA did. They did a three-year program, and my understanding is it's the amount that was transferred to the state was reduced collectively in the neighborhood of about $160 million. So, again, my y-axis starts at 400, so maybe it wouldn't look as dramatic if I had a zero on the bottom, but it has a pretty big impact in terms of, you know, how it affects coverage. That program, all three of the things in the circle, you know, are pretty much on track. They were a little slow, and so 16 is going to be, you know, they're finishing things up, and it's going to cost a little bit more. But I think the more important thing is to look past 16 out to 23 and to think about when we were selling bonds in an environment 2 or 3 years ago, where we thought we'd be in 21 and where we're actually going to be is a gap of a neighborhood of about $150 million. To me, that's the sort of the story in terms of the slowing of the pace. Even we're having to do this video lottery replacement just to kind of hold market share, so to speak. And we had the economists come to a commission meeting and talk in more depth. That might be something you'd be interested in as well to learn more about, because I'm at the end of my knowledge base. Yeah. Other than that,
Chair. Yes, Mazin.
Representative Whitsitt, the lottery has postponed this project for a while, and now they indulged in a complete rechange of and taking out all the machines that they have in about 2,200 places. So this is a big project for them, and it's running slightly more, costing more money. So what basically this does is pulls the whole forecast forward down. We sat on the lottery forecast committee, and this has been an issue discussed several times. So this is not a hole in their way of thinking, but basically a necessity for their program to do.
Okay. But I would say that, you know, a few years ago we were forecasting lottery per biennium bond capacity numbers in the $250 million range. But because of this shift down, you can see that we're just above, we'll be just above the 4x coverage at the end of 15. And you can see that we have about $643 million now forecast going out to stay at 4x coverage. Again, I could open an indenture at a lower coverage, and we could do a lot more lottery bonding, but then that would be fewer dollars available for everything else. Again, divide this number by four bienniums, and you get the $161 million per biennium, which is considerably lower than what we had in the in previous biennium.
Representative Leininger.
Thank you. This is a really great presentation, and I'm really interested in it, and so I'm going to show my newness to the subject. You know, you were identifying different categories of bonded debt that we can incur as a state government, and there are some ceilings imposed on different categories of debt, and there's just some practical times where you want to move from higher cost to lower cost debt. But how do we, who establishes the ceilings for how, what percentage of, you know, our budget we can use for debt payments and what percentage of lottery-backed debt? You know, what body's job does that?
Well, through the chair, that is what the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission's purpose is. Years ago, those 5% ratio for general fund debt was established, as well as this notion at the beginning of when we did lottery bonding in the 80s, we chose 4x coverage. Again, the legislature and ultimately the governor, with approval, can make those ratios anything you want them to be.
I mean, it's. May I ask a follow-up?
Yes, please. Yeah.
You know, it's interesting because since it's a ratio, I mean, it's really quite a moving target, and all of the money that we spend there, as you rightly note, is actual money that we're not spending on other programs, and so it's quite a significant policy decision how much bonded debt we're going to incur. It seems like the kind of thing that would that legislators would want to be extremely actively shepherding. Mm-hmm. And maybe we are, and I'm just, it's
that's
interesting.
That's why I'm here.
Well, let me comment on that. I'm one of the members of the,
right.
of the commission, and one of the things to be aware of is that the commission is purely advisory. Their job is to pull together the information, make sure that a report like this gets published, and then it's up to the Ways and Means Committee, the Capital Construction Subcommittee of Ways and Means, and then ultimately the two houses legislature pass laws, and Laura's absolutely right. We can set it anywhere we want. I think what the point of the commission's report is what our best judgment is as to what's prudent
right.
under the current circumstances. And I don't know if you're getting there, but let me make one additional comment. One of the things we spent a lot of time on this year was the question of the possibility of continued declines in lottery revenue, which would mean that because these debts have the first call on the money, that means the other things that we spend money on would be squeezed, and that would be an issue for Ways and Means and, of course, for the programs that are being funded that way. So one of the things that we said, and maybe Laura's going to get to this later, is that the legislature needs to be careful not to anticipate revenues that may not be there as a part of obligating us to pay long-term debt.
Right.
So, but it's still completely up to the legislature. It's a policy question as to what actually to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Simply, this is simply advice. Representative Whitsitt.
So it's really fair to say that as revenue increases and you have a 5% limit, your debt increases. I mean, that's what we're doing here.
Your
right?
capacity.
Your capacity.
The amount you could borrow.
Right, and we seem to be sort of ever working towards.
Through the chair, I would say not 100% because the 2013 legislature did not choose to use the full amount that the SDPAC report suggested for general fund debt. It did do the full amount for the lottery bonds. Later, OHSU came in with a project in 14, and so we bumped up what was authorized. But just because it's a maximum doesn't necessarily mean the legislature necessarily goes there. So we're trying to give prudent maximum advice through the commission report. As I mentioned earlier, the lottery bonding.
Representative Benz.
Okay.
So I had to ask, thank you, Mr. Chair, I'd ask in one of the committees, I think it was transportation, what ODOT did to reflect the value of the money invested that we generate with these bond sales. And I'm just curious, when it comes to that side of the equation, whether your department asks when we come in begging for money what we did with the last big pile of it you gave us.
I'm not sure how to answer that. We recently did a refunding of ODOT debt that I mentioned it last week, and the refunding savings were in the $35-40 million, and that's savings over time. So that's reducing ODOT's requests for money for other things, or it's freeing up dollars that could be used for other things, I guess would be the best answer. Whenever we constantly monitor the market, whenever bonds are in the money in terms of our ratios, we're always monitoring and pouncing when we can to take in refunding savings. But the money's not all up front. That's the one sad part.
Right. Well, I'm fine with that. We're deeply appreciative of those efforts, and I mean it. I understand the value of your work, and it's amazing. The question is, though, to build on Representative Whitsitt's question, if we chose to borrow up to our capacity, the theory is that we would take those dollars and we would make more with it, and that's why you borrow, is to accelerate, shall we say, the enjoyment of a bridge, for example, and then the increased economic benefit from that investment over time as we pay the bonds back. The question is, how do we measure whether or not that was a good idea? Where does that measurement come back into play? Perhaps not in your department.
Not in my department. I, through the chair, I think that's a valid point, particularly when we come with lottery bonds, because lottery bonds, as I've mentioned, are used for all sorts of economic development. I haven't ever seen anybody go back after the bond money was granted to say, well, how many jobs did it really create? No one that I've read about has actually gone to say, you know, people had ideas when they scored things for Connect Oregon. Mm-hmm. Let's put the money here or there. But no one's really gone in and said, okay, well, when we did Connect Oregon bonds and we put money into port of fill in the blank, what really happened? I've heard anecdotally good stuff, but it would be fascinating to have some very bright University of Oregon or Oregon State students do a research project like that.
Mr. Chair?
Yep.
Thank you. So the question is, are we missing, or is there an agency or somebody that does supply us with the value of that which we invest the money in? And so we could go to our GDP, and eventually we're going to get back to your bond rating and the ability to show that we can pay this stuff back. So I suppose some of us might say, well, of course it was our investments that prompted that incredibly good economy that gives us this great bond rating, but that might be a bit of a stretch.
Through the chair, I'm not aware that there is a single state agency that is doing that type of work at this point in time. I think that there's planning, better planning. DAS is doing more comprehensive capital planning in terms of life cycle costs of buildings and energy efficiency. But I don't know that we have anybody who's really looking at our lottery bonds, which is we're the main vehicle other than ODOT bonding, where we really put money into the state that theoretically has a long-term return.
Thank you.
And I think that may be a comment to make to Ways and Means as they make these kinds of decisions for future reference. Of course, we're starting to do that and have been for the last several years on the tax credit side.
Right. Correct.
But that's a really perceptive, useful question. Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Chair, I cannot resist this opportunity that opened for me.
No.
But I think we have an issue here that is pretty close to the issue of the kicker. I mean, think about it. The 5% revenue type of ceiling, it is a prudent banker mandated kind of thing. Gives you better, but it's not really. If you think about it, financially economic in financial economics, it is not the best way to do it, because the more you make revenue in the good times, the 5% going up, you're borrowing more. In the good times, because the bankers like it when you have money and you could pay, so you're building more in the good times when you actually have all these other projects going and all the pressures on your labor supply and economy and so on. And just when the money tanks,
no worries.
When the money tanks, you have lower capacity because it's the 5%, the revenue going down, and you can't borrow and stimulate your economy.
But
I think there is a problem with this.
Through the chair, we do try and average capacity. In other words, right now we have a big bump. The SDPAC did not say, you have a big bump, do it all right away. So the attempt is to look over a decade and to average your capacity a little bit.
They have a tough job, Mr. Chair. I mean, for a long, but it is what satisfies the bankers and markets and so on is not necessarily what is economically, financially, what you would think the best and ideal. Just like the, you know, the. So I couldn't, but I've been waiting for you to ask this question.
All right. Yeah, you're an aficionado of Krugman, or at least that school of thought, aren't you? You spend money in the government when the economy has lots of extra capacity, and you need something to stimulate things. And you spend it on things that you're going to need over the long run.
And improves you.
And improves your overall capacity in the economy as the economy grows again. Yeah, all those good things. That, of course, is beyond the scope of the treasurer's job, isn't it?
I don't print money.
That's right. Representative Whitsitt.
I wonder if, as a course, it would be better to have a longer time that you're looking over what the patterns are, so you can see cycles versus, you started 2005, I guess 10-year period is what you're looking at there. Have you ever taken it out over a longer time period to see exactly what that extrapolation looks like?
Through the chair, we base our forecast based on OEA's forecast. And I think for OEA, trying to predict the state economy into the 7 to 10 year range is probably guesswork. I hate to use that word, but so the problem is how do you predict a lot of things that long out?
I meant looking back.
I can show you historically. We didn't have a lot of debt before 2004.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, we had very low debt levels.
Like, see that what that looked like, because it's my understanding before 2004, like ODOT went on its own pretty much, and then all of a sudden ODOT started borrowing money, and part of the problem that we're getting is from that. You know, it would just be interesting to see those graphs that you had backwards.
I will send you older copies of the same report that shows you long-term trends historically.
And those are all available online, aren't they?
I don't know how many years back, but if you want to just, I'll start it in 2000 and show you kind of where it's been.
Right.
But I
a whole lot of
through
things
the chair,
happened. Go ahead.
Know,
yeah.
Each time the ODOT was borrowing, we did increase the revenue streams to help cover to pay the debt service. So DMV fees and user fees, wait mile, was increased simultaneously with the authorization of new bonding. Whether you like it or not, that's, you know, how that was the determinations were done.
And it's interesting. We faced a crisis involving the funding for the PERS system and the end of the life of a lot of our roads and bridges at about the same time. 2003-04 is, 50 years after the beginning of the National Defense Highway System. The need to start replacing those bridges. And, of course, we still have a whole lot of those bridges that were built during the go-go days of the 50s and 60s that are now have reached their useful life and need to be replaced. And so how to do that is a real challenge for a state like ours, which when our normal income capacity is used up on operating expenses without dealing with long-term infrastructure costs.
And so, I'm going to turn to some national statistics.
Then I should be quiet and let her finish the report, please.
We won't get into the specifics of ODOT, but as I mentioned, net tax-supported debt is a way that the rating agencies can compare our state debt loads with other states, and that at least gives you a hint as to kind of where we're at. So when we look at net tax-supported, we take all the general fund debt, and then we add in the balance of pension bonds that are paid from non-general fund departments, all of the COPs and Qs that are not paid by the general fund. We take all the ODOT debt that you mentioned and a lottery bond. So that's what we call net tax-supported debt. And so you can see, and I can go backwards and get you older years, but you can see that that number has continued to grow on a per capita as well as personal income basis. It's for 15, it's projected to be roughly, our per capita has been growing, but our personal income is about the same as in 13. And not all states sold pension obligation bonds. Not all states had huge unfunded liabilities. although some states had unfunded liabilities, they just didn't sell pension bonds. So sometimes to compare apples to apples, you've got to take them out. And I'm going to show you a couple charts that talk about that. So this is a 10-year trend for Moody's medians. And Moody's looks every year at all 50 states. And this one is looking at debt per capita. And the green bar is what debt per capita was, the median among all 50 states. And what I've tried to do on the bottom is show you different colors. And I'm sorry it's so small, but at the bottom is the other tax-supported debt. So you get the next one is blue, and that's the lottery debt. We have the COPs that are shrinking. We have the new Qs, which kind of came on in 11, so you can see that kind of replaced it. Then the darker blue is the ODOT bonds that you talked about that we started issuing. And then on top of all that is the POBs. So from a Moody's perspective of public debt, we're considerably higher than the national average. We're like either ranked 11th or 12th. However, people are focusing more on unfunded liability and realizing there's more unfunded state and local liability in the area of pensions than there is public debt in the United States. So to that end, Standard & Poor's try to combine both and do some debt ratios. And this is the newest report that came out last summer. And unfortunately, it only gives you retirement systems through 12. But what I wanted to show you is they take unfunded liability plus your public debt, and they add the two together. And as you know, by 2012, our PERS system was, I think, 93% funded as a whole, 97% funded for 13. When you add together our relatively small amount of unfunded liability plus our public debt, we're actually the sixth lowest ranked overall debt state in the country right now. So let that sink in a minute. Yes, we have issued a lot of ODOT debt. Granted, I totally agree. But again, we were dealing with an unfunded infrastructure that was reaching critical in terms of the bridges and the highways, in terms of its needs for replacement. And we did sell pension bonds, and not every state did. But we have a very well-funded PERS system. So Standard & Poor's is recognizing the importance of looking at all the different components. We have virtually almost no retiree health care liability, which is called OPEB. Some states that are really very high-ranked actually have a lot of OPEB debt. As more and more of this information is brought into balance sheets, because GASB is requiring more and more information,
GASB is
being the Government Accounting Standards Board, as more of this comes into focus, I think you need that holistic look to be able to decide, are we overburdened with debt or not? Because all of these are liabilities. And so I think our numbers are going to stay strong and probably improve. We are a stable AA+ credit with all three rating agencies. We just went in and had presentations in January on the current state of affairs. There's a lot of credit that belongs to the legislature for building up our rainy day funds and building up our educational stability funds, because that was a big part of the presentation. Our debt ratios and the fact that we have a debt capacity approach, whatever ratio you want to use, just that we have a disciplined approach to how we biannually decide how much debt we want to issue. These are all considered credit positives.
Representative Leininger.
Thank you. This is so interesting. So I understand there's been a major change in how transportation facilities are funded, or construction of them has been funded over the last few decades. And from what I understand, and I'd love for you to tell me if this is wrong and help fill in the gaps, the federal government used to pay for a lot of it. The federal government has stepped back the amount that it pays right at a time when a lot of our infrastructure is aging out and needs to be replaced, and we're trying to figure out, states all around the country, trying to figure out how we're going to fund that. Is that where our transportation-related debt comes in? Because we have, we are financing it ourselves by issuing bonded debt, and then is the repayment stream federal money that comes in?
Through the chair, as I mentioned, I wasn't here in the early 2000s, but my understanding is the legislature in 2000, 2001, 3, and 4 maybe authorized different tranches of debt. I think the first two were worth about $500 million, and then the last one was $1.9 billion for OTIA. I wasn't here, but we do not pledge our federal dollars for all of this. This is locally generated money that, as I said, we raised and up. We we bumped up the user fees, the weight mile, and gas tax, DMV fees, to pay for the incremental cost of this debt.
So the repayment stream is those things.
That's right. It's a revenue bond, and that's we have coverage on that, just like we have for our lottery bonds. Our coverage rates are 3 times coverage for the senior debt, and then we have junior debt at 2 times coverage. So we simply leverage the revenue streams. Now, just like lottery bonds, dollars that you spent to pay debt service are dollars you can't use for operation and maintenance. And so, again, that's a policy call for folks as to how much of those revenue streams they want to tie up in debt versus operations.
Mm-hmm. Mazin has done the research on a whole bunch of different areas. This is one of them. Mazin?
Yes, Representative. The transportation funding, actually, in that time that you're talking about, there was a lot more federal funding than, than other times.
Right.
But this was a result of a deficiency in certain infrastructure that we found. And one of them was a bridge. All of a sudden, we looked one day, and there was like 500 cracked bridges that they were out of commission. Right. And therefore, that the OTIA, Oregon Transportation Infrastructure Act, 1, 2, and 3 became, they raised the revenue, and they went on a big construction spree because of the need for infrastructure, not because it was offsetting the federal amounts.
Okay. But because the aging out of the infrastructure and the need to...
Right. Each one of those bills included increases in fees of one kind or another, so that the bonds would be paid for by those charges, by those fees we charged to people who were either driving big trucks or people who were driving passenger cars. So every one of those bills was internally funded.
It wasn't taken from the...
It wasn't taken from something else. We didn't have the money to take it from anywhere else. We had to raise charges somehow in order to pay for those bridges. And Mazin's referring to a set of bridges that were improperly engineered that had started to fail. And so there were a number of bridges especially around the West Coast, that had this problem. Other states either had fewer of them or had gotten a head start on us to getting those replaced. But we had a whole bunch of them, and I think they're mostly gone now, aren't they, Mazin? Most of those improperly engineered bridges?
I think a lot of them are fixed.
There's one over the Columbia River that we still need to work on.
Well, of course, that's just simply old.
I know.
We're talking about a particular engineering error that was repeated over and over again in a whole lot of different bridges. I can't remember the name of it.
The one thing I should add through the chair is that I've seen a large increase in the amount of toll bonding as well, and that's sort of a longer-term trend, whether it's a publicly owned or privately owned facility in order to do new roads, and in some cases to just fund the cost of maintenance of old roads, particularly in the South and as well as on the East Coast, and frankly in Washington State, just to do the bridges over Lake Washington. Mm-hmm. Everything is moving more and more towards user fees and toll bonding.
Of course, we tried to do that with the Columbia River crossing twice. And it wasn't successful because Washington wouldn't go along. Yeah. Please, go ahead.
Okay. I'm going to wrap up. So a few things in non-tax supported. This is a list of the GEO, the direct revenue, and the conduit programs that we call the non-tax supported. So in each case, there are monitors, even though it's not tax supported, Treasury as well as folks who do budgeting for each of these agencies keeps an eye on making sure that they have the revenue streams that they need to pay the debt service on bonds that are sold. There are a couple of issues that we have brought up. One of them is that we have been looking at some state guarantees that we do for school district and community college bonds. And my office basically processes what's called the Oregon School Bond Guarantee. And if school districts meet certain criteria when they sell their general obligation bonds, the state will basically guarantee that if they don't make the debt service payment, we'll make it on their behalf. Yeah. But it's a state aid intercept. So we would make that payment. We would turn around and take, theoretically take their state aid. That would probably destroy the district. But that allows those school districts to carry the same credit rating on their bonds as our state credit rating. And for a lot of school districts in the A category or double B plus category, that's a huge interest rate savings when they sell their bonds. That program has grown by leaps and bounds, and so for the last several years, we've been writing little reports about that. What we noticed more recently is that there's a second guarantee program that Treasury's not involved in, and it's basically a fund diversion agreement that school districts and community colleges can enter into with Department of Education that does the same thing and guarantees their pension obligation bonds. But Treasury hasn't been part of it, even though it could take the same state aid that we would need to take if there was ever a problem in repayment. So this picture just shows you how the school bond guarantee program's grown since the demise of bond insurance companies. We're really the only game in town. So this chart just shows you how much the program's grown since 08. And it's a $5 billion in terms of overall guarantees around the state for just the school bond guarantee part. There was about $3 billion sold through these pension obligation diversion agreement between 2002 and 2007, with more being talked about actually currently in terms of the low interest rate environment. There's some school districts looking at it again. And Treasurer's Office feels it is pretty important. I think I have a picture that shows you on a combined basis how much the combined annual debt service guarantee has been growing. The pension bonds that were sold had upward sloping amortization. So by that, they started out with relatively low principal payments, and then they ramped up. So you can see that the red shows you how that's been growing each year. And that's real state aid that's going, that you're appropriating to the Department of Education, which they're moving to a fiscal agent who's paying the debt service. So we're projecting that in fiscal year 15, which we're in, it's about 7%. And that's real hard money that's moving over. The balance is the blue, and that's the contingent liability. We've never actually had to actually come out of pocket and pay a penny in state aid because, again, it's all voter-approved GO bonds. But basically, if there was a tsunami or an earthquake or some other major disaster in a school district, property tax base fell apart, then that's a real, very real possibility that we would have to step in and make those payments. And so on a contingent basis, we're in the neighborhood of 24% on a combined basis of state aid is being tied up in a guarantee. The Treasurer's Office thinks it's really important that we've put some limits on a per school district or community college district basis. We've tightened our rules and said we don't want you to have more than 80% of your state aid tied up, even if it's contingent. We think that it's fiscally, it's a little dangerous place to be. But because we don't know what's going on in the pension bonds, we would request that the legislature consider disincluding Treasury in the process for future fund diversion agreements so that we can get a complete picture of what a school district or community college is doing. And we've introduced a bill to do that.
You've just answered my question, Representative Bega Peterson.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for this information. It's really helpful. On the chart that was on slide 25 when it ranked where Oregon was ranked in our overall liabilities, is this debt included in that calculation?
No, it's not.
Okay.
Because that chart is looking at our unfunded liabilities for PERS, and it's looking at our public debt. So this school bond guarantee, since we've never come out of pocket mm-hmm. and we've never had to sell bonds or anything to kind of cover that, that's just all contingent liability. So this sits on top of that. And again, we monitor it. We try and be helpful to school districts and community colleges, but it's reaching a point where we've been sort of starting to send up little bit red flags that we think that the program needs to be tightened up a bit.
Representative Whitson.
So your school bond guarantees are not just for capital construction, or are they?
Through the chair, just for GO bonds that are capital construction that have been approved by voters.
Oh, okay, because one of the districts in my district actually took bonds and used them to pay to operate and buy books mm-hmm. and pay teachers, and I was wondering how that falls under anything in the state here.
Well,
it was disturbing to know we're going to pay for those school books for 20 years.
I don't know the specific district, but the only bonds that we approve are general obligation bonds. Okay. And I thought under state law, those would have to be for bricks and mortar. So there could be other bonds that are called full faith and credit bonds mm-hmm. that where they're basically general revenue pledges. But we wouldn't be guaranteeing those. Okay. So maybe we could talk afterwards about the specific bond. And I'm not sure what district you're in, but we wouldn't have any knowledge if they did something illegal in terms of use of bond proceeds.
I'm not saying they did. I just don't know what kind of bonds they sold.
We could look it up. We have a database okay, in my office great. Where we can give you more details than you ever want, but every school district sponsors.
That would be a glad to help with that. Yeah, good.
So the bill that we are going to introduce is Senate Bill 303, which I believe is being heard in the next week or so, at least initially. And it's just simply to include Treasury in the review and approval process.
Mr. Chair?
Representative
Can I ask how you got to the 80% number?
Well, yes, through the chair. we a few years ago, the legislature authorized me to upgrade our bond tracking system. And so we went from kind of an older-fashioned database to a really robust system. And so I was able to extract this information and look on a district-by-district basis, and I got state aid information for the first time. And lo and behold, there was a couple of districts where over 100% of their state aid was guaranteed because of the overlap. And then I looked at all the other districts, and they were down in the 40, 50, 60. So I thought, 80%, well, I don't want other school districts to get up to 100 unless they pledge some additional bond insurance or they have collateral. I'm trying to think from a state perspective. So I think I looked at a number that the school districts weren't at, except for the ones that were over the limit, and just thought that would be a good cap. But it's not scientific. We could have picked a lower number, and then a lot of school districts would be able to benefit any longer. So I tried to find a happy medium.
That's, if I may follow up, that's specifically why I asked, because so much of this information of what you and what you do is so specific. And I thought to myself, oh, I wonder if there is a strict scientific formula to how you got to that 80%.
I think there's a lot of rules.
Know that
of
it's
thumb.
Not always. Yes.
Through the chair, the tricky part is we want to be helpful as a state, but I also think we need to be careful that we don't help our communities to the point where some disaster happens, and we are really literally faced with, do we really take their state aid, because that's what the law says, or do we have to bail them out with general fund dollars? And so that is the downside of being helpful.
Part of your expertise and part of the expertise of people who rate bonds is the evaluation of risk. I mean, that's a big chunk of it, isn't it? And when you talk about this 80% number, I'm assuming you're also dealing with the reality that most school boards are not used to thinking that way. They think in a short-term pragmatic way for the most part. This establishes useful guidelines for them as they think about how they get into deep water, because you've established a guideline for them, not because they necessarily understand the issues.
Through the chair, the three districts that had higher ratios were rich school districts where their voters had approved lots of debt, and they don't get a lot of state aid. So it was Dunthorpe, Sisters, and Nestucca. But there are some community colleges on the coast that have a fair amount as well. And I started worrying about like tsunamis and what ifs.
Representative Johnson, did you have something? No, okay.
Okay. The second area that is one of our big issues of concern that there hopefully will be a bill in the very near future is that the breakup of the university system and the transformation to independent status that was incorporated in Senate Bill 270, there's obviously always going to be technical issues that need to be worked out in the transition. And we've been in the process of trying to refund some bonds that were issued for the universities under Article 11 F and G. And in that process, we discovered there's kind of some missing linkages and administrative oversight details. In the absence of having a chancellor's office who can authorize the treasurer's office to sell refunding bonds, even for things that the general fund pays for, we don't have a state agency any longer to play this administrative oversight role, which made the refunding complicated in that I had to get approval from individual boards. And right now I have three of those in OUS, and in July we'll have seven plus OHSU, so that's eight. It's just logistically impossible. Plus, there's a lot of ongoing post-issuance compliance tax law matters that need to be managed. And if people reuse facilities in ways, as you mentioned, bonds were sold for one purpose and then over time get used differently, it could have huge consequences in terms of the tax status of those bonds, which could affect the state credit in a massive way. And so Treasury feels it's really quite critical that we identify a state agency to participate and play an oversight role. There's questions as to whether there's a university shared services group, which is no longer part of a state agency, it's part of Oregon State, whether some of the work can be outsourced to them, but there needs to be a state agency actor playing a role in this process. And so there'll be probably, hopefully, in the very near future, a bill that we can offer to the legislature for their consideration is once we work out those details. But in the absence of that, we're not sure that we can sell the bonds that have been authorized by the legislature this May, because I simply don't have a tax compliance management organization that the state can rely on. So the treasurer has stated that we need this to be resolved early in the session.
You're aware of our timelines, and
I believe that new legislation has to be introduced by February 20th.
Very, very soon. I don't remember the
exact date. I have a draft legislative concept that needs to be confirmed by a lot of parties. There's a lot of, obviously, people who have different points of view, but it's simply just a practical. We need a state agency involved in our bond transactions.
That should sharpen interest on the part of the universities if they know that they can't sell their bonds without getting this done.
Yes.
Representative Whitsitt.
Who would you recommend? What?
Treasury, the state treasurer wrote a letter to the governor this fall, and we think there's two agencies that could either perform that role. The Higher Education Coordinating Commission, the word coordinating, would be one, and the other would be Department of Administrative Services. So those are the at least the oversight entities, but then the devil's in the details of who does the day-to-day operating aspects. And we've had great success so far. The University Shared Services staff that we work with were the same people who are in the chancellor's office, but they're no longer part of state. They're not in a state government, and there's just legal liability that we feel we need to protect our interests. So in conclusion, I've shared with you sort of how we go about coming up with the per biennium numbers. Those are maximums, not requirements. So it's a cap. It's not a minimum. We try to stay conservative, and that has really served us well over the test of time. Obviously, we've said that lottery is really struggling, and that the most we think we ought to do per biennium now is 161. I did run some numbers, and just theoretically, if we change that, you know, four times coverage, which is 25%, and said let's make it 20%, that would mean that we wouldn't sell any lottery bonds until 2020. So if the legislature wanted to tighten that rule of thumb, that would mean we'd need to take a holiday. And I've been told anecdotally that there was over $1 billion in lottery bond requests that was sent to the governor. So the push-pull is, even if you would really like to scale back, there's a lot of folks throughout the state who have really grown to love the lottery bond program because it is great grant money to seed fund a lot of different things in the state. That's
very
it.
Good. Any other questions? Representative Bantz.
Yeah, so on the next page of your conclusions, it said while Oregon's net tax-supported debt ratio remains above the national average of the state overall liability, which is the sum of both its public debt and unfunded PERS, is well below national averages. This is just a swing at the fact that national averages, given how poorly many states have done, are a pretty sad measure for us. Is that a correct take on
it? I use medians, but I would still argue yes.
Yes.
I think that there are some states that are in real trouble in the long run. But there's even some very high-rated states, like Virginia. I used to work in Virginia long ago, who have their pension system is only funded in the 60-plus percent range.
Wow.
Shocking results.
Whoa.
So, I mean, I think this problem is something that legislators around the country are going to be grappling with for quite a long time. It was very painful, I'm sure, at the state to do the pension reforms that were done in 2003 and then again in 13. But all of those pension reforms collectively have brought us to where we are today in terms of where we're funded. And many states are struggling with how to get there themselves now.
And, of course, we're still worried about the gap we still have. Even though our gap is much, much tinier than
I think that in 2014, CAFR, we actually have a surplus on because we mark to market. So believe it or not, we are in maybe not the PERS report yet, but on the CAFR report, the bring up put us to the good. Now, if the state loses the case on the COLA cap,
right,
we'll be back in the red.
All right, Representative Bantz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was just to set this one up, and so I'm not sure what the justification is for putting the first together with the second and it's almost as though it masks the unfortunate situation we have where we are above the national average when it comes to our net tax-supported debt ratios. So I don't like that. And so my question is, justify it for me. Why is it
I think you need to look at both, through the chair. I think you need to look at both. Public debt is public debt. It's hard debt. And the thing about PERS is you can change some of the rules, and it's considered soccer debt because you can change your earnings rate, your amortization patterns. And so I think you need to look at both. I think on a public debt basis, we're well above national medians. But we sold pension bonds. And so you have to say, okay, not every state did that. But states all, not all, but every state might have a PERS system. Some are well-funded and some are unfunded. And so looking at both gives you, I think, a more comprehensive look at your overall balance sheet. That simply looking at one part of your debt, but not all of your debt, doesn't necessarily capture.
Okay, yeah. So I'm perfectly happy with looking at all the debt. I'm very happy it's captured here. But my general understanding is a very nice word, overstates it, of the PERS situation is that the nature of those obligations is somewhat different than the type of debt that is in the first part of the equation. I don't think they're the same at all, to be honest with you. And the reason is because of the influence of those folks that try to capture the amount that's actually going to be due. So the people in there writing, whatever their names are, I always want to say annuitants, that's not right.
Milliman, the actuary?
Actuaries.
Yeah.
The actuaries remind me a lot of others that deal in situations where we can do an adjustment here, adjustment there, and suddenly we're talking billions. And it just doesn't seem the same as a note. And
I understand. So that's why it's a soft debt. Because you can change
debt.
The assumptions.
You can change the assumptions, right.
Right.
So that's why I'm asking. I'm all in favor of looking at both, but I don't know how we can equate them.
Well, through the chair, the only thing I'd say when I do the rating presentations is we have transparency, at least we have for several years, because we've been marking to market our PERS. Other states bring in their losses and gains over typically 5 years, but some cases longer. And so, you know, losses and gains can be sitting off, and the actuaries are bringing those in. And when we talk to the rating agencies, one of the credit positives is that what you see is what you get. Granted, there's assumptions about age and this and that, but you know at any moment in time exactly what the portfolio is valued at. Obviously, this is only as good as your valuation techniques, but to me, the state moved towards a more transparent method to evaluate. It took a long time because when things were crummy in 08 and 09, and we were marked to market and everybody was bringing their losses, we looked really bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept telling them, but we're marked to market. And now you're starting to see why we look so good.
Yeah.
Because everybody's had to bring in their losses.
Yeah.
So I think you're right, but I also think there's some value in terms of looking at where we've been. Our trends are fairly strong. It's only as good as the stock market in a given year. I would agree with that.
Okay. Thank you.
There's no bumper sticker approach to any of this. It all of it is complex, and there are always trade-offs. I mean, when we decided to buy bonds, or to sell bonds, rather, for the pension obligation, it was because we thought we would do better by selling bonds and by investing the money in the pension system than by simply carrying the debt in the pension system and trying to fund it over time with the money that otherwise would have gone to pay the bonds. So far, at least, I think our bet has paid off in the sense that the cost of the bonds is less than the amount that we've been able to earn with the money that went into the pension system. I mean, these are the kinds of decisions that are not much fun to make, and you better make them correctly, or you're in worse trouble. But it was a legislative decision to do that. It wasn't something the Treasurer decided to do. And so far, that particular one, at least, seems to be paying off for us. Is that a reasonable statement to make?
Yes, sir. I would say the state would have been funding its unfunded liability at the time at about 8%, and the bonds were sold taxably at 5.75%. Other school districts did it. Some did it early in the biennium, in the decade. Some sold it later. The ones who sold it later in the decade didn't get the big bump in the stock market.
Right.
There are two or three school districts I know of right now who are doing pension bonds, full faith and credit. Whether you think it's smarter not to put the money in the market right now, they're borrowing taxably 20-year debt at 3.4%. Otherwise, they would have to amortize the unfunded at, I think it's 7.75% right now. So those, that's a financial decision. GFOA has sort of come out with advisories strongly warning people that it's speculative, and I think there's a lot to be said for that, but it's awfully tempting to take that liability. Again, you're making it a hard liability, and to try and lower that number substantially, right, in terms of what you're putting into the system. So the state, I don't know the exact number, Paul Cleary retired, but he used to keep track of it, but before he retired, I know we were at least $260 million to the good of what we'd have otherwise had to kick into the system by doing. It did push our debt ratios, for sure.
You know, I would just like to add that I think that Treasurer in this iteration of the world, the Oregon Treasury, including you, have done a couple of really important things for the legislature. One of them is that you continually explain to us how this stuff works so that we can make the best decisions we can make under the circumstances. And to some extent, these decisions are political, but to some extent, they're not. They're simply based on the needs that Oregon has at the time and what's the best, the most likely approach to get through them in a way that's beneficial for Oregonians. And without an agency like yours, we would be making these decisions, but we wouldn't have the information or the background to make them as wisely as I think the legislature has been able to do over the last decade that I've been paying attention to this. The other thing you do for us is that you manage it, that you figure out ways to reduce our costs, to get us a lower interest rate, to shift something around in a way that that gives us a financial advantage as we go along. And, of course, that last little piece, maintaining the systems in place, a la the universities you talked about earlier, that allow you to do those things in a way that are seamless so that we don't expect the legislature, the presidents of the universities, the superintendents of the school districts to understand the details of all of this stuff, because we have a real expert right here in Salem that does understand them and that can advise us about the best approach. Doesn't mean you're always going to be right, but boy, it's sure better to have you than not. And I want to thank you. Is there anything else for Laura today?
I just want to make sure I get everything represented. I might need a list from you, so I'll give you
right.
My card.
Can you two be in communication then?
So make sure you get it.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I know you're on the next piece. With that, we'll close the information meeting on debt management, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2493. It's the second one on the list. Mazin, do you want to introduce it? And then we'll hear from Laura and Drew.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the House Bill 2493 is a bill that comes almost a complementary of the issue. This is about the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission. This is amends the section of the law 286A.250, which actually describes what the commission is composed of and how often does it meet. This changes the time of the meeting. This bill does from 6 months, at least once every 6 months, to at least once a year. So that's the gist of this bill, and you have a preliminary SMS on your office.
So through the chair, I think it was brought up by someone that we weren't following the exact rules, but our practice has been to meet right before legislative session. So we usually have an annual meeting or two meetings in January. And so I think this is just a technical cleanup to conform statute to practice. The other piece that didn't quite make it this round but perhaps would be worth consideration is that we used to have a six-year forward forecast for lottery and general fund from OEA, and a few years ago they moved to a 10-year forecast period. So rather than have a specific number of years, my suggestion would be to modify that part of the statute that just says the OEA forecast periods, because it varies. Right now we have 8 years out because we're partway through a biennium plus the two we're in. And so sometimes it's 10 years and sometimes it's 8. But rather than pick a number, just make sure it's long term so that, again, our practice and statute are tied together.
Nothing to add on that one.
Thank you. Questions? We have been meeting about once a year, certainly not every 6 months.
There's not enough difference to change things.
Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on House Bill 2493? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2493 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2490.
And, Mr. Chair, the House Bill 2490 is also the treasurer bill, and this has to adjust, I believe, a mistake that was done in the 2013 session, where it allows the tribes to enter their money into the local government pool, and in that you have in section subsection 3 of section 1 the bill where you look at the change in the date of when you allow the this $30 million to increase based on the consumer price index, and it seems to have chosen a September 9th date rather than an end of the month or a beginning of a month, and that's probably was an inadvertent, and this bill attempts to correct that.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Drew Johnston. For the record, I'm the legislative director for the Oregon State Treasury. This bill is exactly as Mazin described it, a simple fix. We believe that the September 9th date is an antecedent of history and kind of an accident in statutory construction, given that consumer price indexes aren't done on a daily basis. We would just want to change that to August 31st so we can give local governments the kind of information that they need, given that the local government investment pool is something that's very important for them. There's nearly $12 billion in funds that state agencies and local governments use for their short-term investment needs, and they can get yield back whenever they need the money.
Mm-hmm. Questions? Is there a difference in the actual number that you get on August 31, 1995, as compared to September 9th, 1995?
No, and that's
the thank you. That's all I needed to know, because that matters, because that's the number that everything else is based on, the date. But if the number is the same on those two dates, then the rest of it follows, I think.
Chair Barnhart, there is no September 9th date, and so I think whereas before
you were using August 31st anyway.
Yeah. Okay. Well, all before right. Senate Bill 351, that date really wasn't used in the same way it is now. And okay. So for the past year, we use August 31st.
Gotcha. All right, Representative Vance.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have any idea where the date came from, the September 9th? Can we trace this back to someone drinking heavily, or what was it?
Someone's birthday.
Someone's birthday. Yeah. Just curious. It could have been
someone's birthday. It could have been one of those record long 95 sessions that ended as the final date. Who knows?
Well, it's 9/9, so it makes it's a nice date to. If it was 9/9/99, it would be a perfect date.
Right. All right. Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on House Bill 2490? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2490. Colleagues, it will be my intention to schedule these for a work session soon. Do we have time to do the timber tax background, or at least get started on it? Okay, let's do it then. We'll open an informational meeting on timber tax background.
Yeah, I'm sure
set that for another day.
Okay, yeah. I just didn't know what kind of
turn my brain on to another topic.
Right. Well, and the shift, colleagues, it indicates the breadth of the things this committee gets to do. Paul?
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this committee spent a lot of time on the timber taxation issue, especially in the 1990s with the Measure 5 phase-in, and there were a number of different iterations of that. You have had a structure that was put in place at that time and hasn't radically changed since about 2001. In 2000, decades of our staff prepared a background piece on the history of timber, tracking all the revenue sources, putting all together. And this interim, Christine went back through and redid that that research report, getting new information, getting a lot of feedback from the Department of Forestry. So she's going to walk through that with you. And so as a background, any policy discussions you have around timber taxation.
Great. Blaze.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'm Christine Broniak with the Legislative Revenue Office. And yes, this presentation is really about forest revenues in Oregon and the history of the changes that have happened, particularly in the 90s. But to start with, I would go way back to about in the 1920s. And at the time, a lot of forests were old growth, and people would buy the land, and industry was would then extract the timber. The assessor would come around and value the standing trees, and the industry or the landowner would pay property tax based on the value of the timber as well as the value of the land. So it was treated as a piece of property, kind of like any other piece of property. In the 1970s, they began to exempt the standing timber itself from the property tax, and the reason for this was the they left some harvest. There's kind of a bit of a strange incentive to harvest really quickly when the industry knows that they're going to be taxed on the standing timber. The incentive there is to cut it down as quickly as you can so that you wouldn't have to pay taxes on it. So therefore, the change that they made was to replace that tax on the portion of tax on the standing timber as a severance tax. And so that would be a tax that you paid at the time that the trees were cut down. So it removed some of that incentive for really rapid harvest. And so that structure was what was in place all the way through to 1990. And the land was valued per acre, and this was according to values adopted by the Oregon Supreme Court. And they were indexed forward according to the changes in stumpage value. The severance tax, which was intended to replace the value of the tax on the standing timber, was 6.5% of harvest value in the West and 5% of harvest value in the East. There was a special program for small tract land, and it was taxed on productivity value and completely exempt from the severance tax. So, you know, the philosophy of the forest taxation was that there were two distinct phases. But prior to 1990, the severance tax, like I mentioned, was replacing the property tax on standing trees. This is more a time when harvesting timber was akin to mining. The producers didn't have to do much as far as creating the resource. The resource was just there. Old growth timber for most of the history was relatively abundant. And typically mining taxes are where the resource is taxed at the point of extraction. And so by 1993, nearly all the old growth had gone on both private forest lands and federal lands, aside from some perhaps isolated patches. So forestry at this point began to more closely resemble farming. Industry had to actively replant in order to have more production. And at this point, the legislature made a series of decisions in the changes made in the 90s and early 2000s to treat forest taxation more like the tax that happens on farming. You don't have, for a farmer, a tax on standing corn. They're just taxed on their land, albeit a specially assessed value, and then pay, you know, income taxes on the harvest, potentially. And so the changes that were made were done, I think, with this philosophy of, you know, without commenting on whether this is right or wrong, it was thought that this was timber was supposed to be treated as a farm commodity instead of something more akin to mining or resource extraction. Because indeed there was no harvest unless the producers would actually plant at that point, because there wasn't a lot of old growth left. So this slide is titled "A Tax by Any Other Name." In 1990, Measure 5 would phase in limitations on tax rates imposed on property. The AG opined that the severance taxes were indeed taxes on property and would be subject to the limits imposed by Measure 5. In response, House Bill 2550 redefined the severance taxes as privilege taxes. And so really it was the same concept. It's a tax that's paid upon harvest of the trees. And they did that in order to make it so that it wasn't considered part of the limitations for property tax under Measure 5. But they did reduce the rates. So they had a rate between 91 and 92 of 5.85%. And that reduced revenues by $5.4 million. And in 1992-93, the rate was lowered to 5.3%. And that reduced revenues by $9.8 million. And the 93-94 rate was 4.7%. And so it was calculated at the time in the revenue impact statement. It said that these reduced rates had less revenue loss associated with them than if the severance taxes had been reduced to comply with Measure 5. So this was the era also of a lot of studies. An interim study was commissioned to advise the 1993 legislature on this matter. And at the point when the 1993 legislature met, they revised the tax policy further to exempt 80% of the value of the land from property tax. And this was to begin in 1995-96. And the idea was that privilege taxes were thought to have replaced the taxes on standing timber, but those, because they decided to treat forestry like farming, wouldn't be applicable anymore. They still retained the privilege taxes, however, in order to recoup at least the 80% of the tax value that they had foregone at that point. They also changed the valuation of the forest land. The values per acre, like I said, had previously been set by the Supreme Court. House Bill 2438 set them in statute, and beginning in the 95-96 tax year. The bill also required DOR to evaluate these values and report to the 1995 legislature. And the department was directed to review forest land values every 6 years. So the changes that were made by the 1993 legislature had revenue losses associated with them, and those are outlined in this this table. So $26.6 million was lost in 95-97, and this was due to foregoing 80% of the tax on the land itself. And then these reductions in privilege taxes, 3.8% in Western Oregon in 95, and then 3.2% thereafter. So the total was $40 million a biennium in impact, and then even more in 97-99 as that 3.2% rate continued and the 80% discount on the rate, the tax rate on the land continued. And so by 1999, the legislature phased out privilege taxes and phased in a new 100% ad valorem tax system on the land. There was a three-year period where the land would be taxed at 75% of its value from 2001, 2002, and 2003. There was a special program for small landowners, less than 5,000 acres. They had the option to participate in the new program, and they called the new program the Oregon Forest Land Program. And they also had the option to stay with the 1997 taxation arrangement, which was taxation according to the productivity value. By 2003, 2004, the valuation was slated to increase to this 100% level. And so to comply with Measure 50, this would be the smaller of the specially assessed value or the maximum assessed value. And the legislature required interim studies to value highest and best use forest land. There were some issues of potentially a large number of value appeals in response from being taxed on 20% of the land to being taxed on 100%. So by 2001, the legislature was advised by an interim study group, and it was charged with developing an alternative method of taxation for forest lands and small ownerships. The group had not arrived at a consensus, and so the legislature took away the option for the small tract forest land to be taxed according to productivity value and said, okay, everybody is going to be taxed under the Oregon Forest Land Program now. And privilege taxes, after being phased down for a while, had been eliminated on January 1st, 2003. And so the 2001 legislature also passed House Bill 3537, and this directed the DOR to adopt specially assessed values for forest land. And the valuation of forest land by DOR continues to this time. And so by 2003, the small landowners work groups had finally agreed on something and or a plan with which to treat small lands. And so those that had less than 5,000 acres had the opportunity again to opt out of the Oregon Forest Land Program and to participate in the Small Tract Forest Land Program. So this program and this structure continues to this day. They defer 80% of the property taxes on the land in exchange for paying a severance tax that's levied when the timber is harvested. Rates are designed to recover that 80% of the tax on the land that's not being paid, and they are currently $5.18 per 1,000 board feet for Western Oregon in 2014. And so here, the history, you can see some of the maximum assessed values per acre. In 2014-15, the Department of Revenue does come up with specially assessed values. However, those numbers are a lot higher than the maximum assessed values. So it's in compliance with Measure 50, the smaller of the two. And so this is effectively what is paid per acre for various site classes. And FA is the highest quality land, most suitable, and FX is the least high quality land. And so you can kind of see the values per acre. I've also kind of been looking at, you know, Washington and California. Their values per acre are somewhat lower. However, they still have severance taxes in place. So that the mix is a little different in other states. But the value per acre is about a third lower in those states. And so an overall schematic, there's a lot of changes throughout time, and it can be a little confusing. But Link Cannon was kind enough to provide me with this kind of schematic of what values were at different times in history. You can see the green along the bottom here is the tax rates on the land itself. And then above that, the yellow were privilege tax rates, and you can see that they were phased out eventually. And it phased in the 2003-05 biennium to what we have today, which is they value 100% of the forest land according to specially assessed values, mm-hmm. and there's no privilege taxes remaining. Of course, except for the forest products harvest tax. And so one of the perhaps more important points here is how this hit the revenue components in Oregon. And so you can see the privilege taxes being phased out had a significant impact on revenue. One of the reasons for this was that the privilege tax could be charged on harvest on national forest land. And that has, as you know, may or may not know, has gone away by and large, at least at the volumes that it used to be sustained at. And so the Western Oregon property tax, and here you can see the through the 95-96 biennium and through to 2000, that there was that 20% rate, and then you could see the 70% rate for 75% rate for 3 years, and then back to 100%. And then privilege taxes and in Western and Eastern Oregon nearly go away, and the small amount that's there is attributable to the small tract forest land program. And so it can be worthwhile to compare the amount of revenues to the overall harvest levels, which have also gone down in this time period. You can see the federal harvest in particular has declined fairly substantially. And, you know, private harvest moves more along with the business cycle and according to the demand for timber and also the world market. But you can then compare that to the revenue source. And for the amount of, given the amount of harvest, it's safe to say that the revenue has declined along, you know, with the policy decision to treat forest land as farmland as opposed to more of a traditional resource extraction model.
Okay.
So that concludes.
Questions, comments? Who did I miss?
Representative
Leininger.
I just want to say that's really interesting information, and I'm going to have to take a close look at it, you know, later on today, but it's fascinating and really helpful to see all that laid out.
Thanks. Thank you.
I think it's interesting that the legislature has put the effort in, many legislatures have put such a huge effort into what is in reality a fairly small portion, at least now, of our total tax receipts. I think $90 million back in 94-95 was a very considerable amount of tax receipts. And of course it was concentrated in a few counties. Mm-hmm. So I can see why that actually happened. Part of the issue for me has been that I have had a number of people raise the question of a review of the way we tax timber and timberland because of the difference between the amounts of dollars that we used to receive and what we receive now. I think most of the people who are asking for that kind of review may not understand the magnitude of the issue as compared to other tax issues that we deal with here. But of course, it is more important in those counties that have a lot of private timberland where the timber production is going on. Thank you. Other comments, questions? I appreciate the review very much. This will be useful for us as we go ahead. I don't know if we have any bills on changing our system or not, but if we do, we're well prepared.
Okay.
Thank you. With that, committee, we will close the information meeting. We will see you again tomorrow at 1 o'clock. And with that, committee is adjourned.